You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How might the approach of big history change our thinking about the history of the world and the role of humanity in its shape? With us now is history professor Jonathan Markley. Markley teaches big history at California State University Fullerton, and he's hosted a series of television programs on the subject. Welcome to The Scholar Circle, Jonathan Markley. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start with this concept of big history. How would you describe big history and how it's distinct from what other historians do?
Big history is the ultimate in macro history, when you're really trying to zoom out and get a handle on everything that's going on. There's a lot of metaphors that have been used, but one I rather like is that of aerial archaeology. So traditional archaeology, you're on the ground, you're digging in the dirt, you're sifting through every little piece, looking for a bone, looking for a coin, finding the foundations. But then on the other hand, if you get in a plane and you're high above the desert, you can suddenly see patterns that would be invisible at a lower level. You can see where the highways go. You can see, oh, suddenly we're digging in a palace. This is part of a larger structure. So it's not something that could ever replace traditional archaeology, but at the same time, without somebody looking at the bigger picture, it's hard to really get a full understanding of what's going on.
So you've got the big picture, you're talking about archaeology, but it seems like what you do is more from the entire history of the planet.
Very true. The original concept or idea of a big history course was when David Christian, a professor at Macquarie in Sydney, was just in a history department meeting, and he sort of just threw an idea out to his department. Wouldn't it be great if we could have a history course that actually started at the Big Bang and went all the way through to the present? And his colleagues all looked at him and said, good idea, why don't you do it? So that was where it was born. So it does certainly have a lot of overlap, because the early part has, you know, physics and biology and chemistry. But it does go right through up until the present. And I think actually it's one of the fields of history that actually does give you some hope of having at least a little bit of predictive power into the future. Everybody always says, you know, you need to study history in order to understand where we're going. But most of the time, historians are pretty shy about attempting to do that.
I understand that Microsoft founder Bill Gates is now funding this, I guess we could call it a big history movement, to teach this in schools. What do you know about that?
Well, again, this is something that came about through David Christian, who's sort of the guy who coined the term. He was actually working in the same Cal State system as me, but down in San Diego. And he made one of those learning company DVD series or CD series, you know, where people can buy them. And it turned out, little did we know, that Bill Gates is a big fan of history of science. And when he's in the gym on the running machine, he listens to these sort of recorded classes. And he listened to this one by David Christian, thought it was rather good, and then got his secretary to give David Christian a call. And when you hear David tell the story, it's quite funny. He says he was having a really bad day. He picked up the phone and said, "What?" And he said there was this very nice young lady at the other end of the phone who said, Mr. Gates would like to meet you. And David said, well, he knew the answer to that question. So anyway, long story short, they met up, and Bill Gates said he wanted to fund the development of all the materials and all the tools and the assistance to set this up as a high school course. And that's the Big History Project. And it's still being funded by Bill Gates. It's still entirely free. All the resources are there. There's some really good resources where the teachers sort of get together and give each other advice, showing how they can fit it into traditional curriculum. They've got schools doing it in Australia, in Korea, quite a number in the United States. So it is something that's gradually been spinning up. They're up to, I'm not sure what the latest count is, but I know it's several hundred schools at least.
So in addition to teaching and researching, you've also been doing some television. And one of the episodes that I saw dealt with science and religion. And you said you had come across a document from the Catholic Church. What was that document and what does it mean for these two paradigms?
The particular document you're referring to was Pope John Paul II. And he was addressing the Papal Academy of Sciences. And they were taking as their topic of study the question of human evolution. Now, normally, people immediately hear church and evolution and assume they must be in opposition to each other. But, in fact, the Pope was saying then, and he was building on some of the writings of earlier popes, where he said the Catholic Church is in fact very interested in this question because they want to know where human beings came from. And they have no problem at all with the concept that human beings could be created out of pre-existing biological material. So in other words, you could have an evolutionary process that would lead to human beings. But of course, their doctrine still maintains the concept that there is a significant difference between humans with a soul and animals that don't. But the idea that human being could emerge through evolutionary processes was something that the Catholic Church has no problem with.
You've actually argued that religion is a bit of an attempt at what you're calling big history. How do you see that?
In the early days, well, not just early days, the big history has been called a creation story. And the idea there is that every human society that has ever existed wants to have a creation story. They want to know where it began. They want to know how it developed. And they want to think about where it might end up. So in that sense, the Big Bang theory, the expanding universe, the solar system formation, and the ultimate fate of the universe ties in with a very deep human need. It's one of those interesting things, again, which you see when you zoom out on a wider scale. If you look at every human society that's ever existed, every single one's had a creation story. So, you know, if we discovered some new island somewhere in the Pacific with a human tribe that had been out of contact with other humans for 10,000 years, we could predict certain things about them. And one of them is they would have a creation story. So in each case, they're building on what they know. So you can't have a theory about where things come from if you don't have a certain amount of knowledge. Like, for example, Big Bang cosmology came about initially because some of the discoveries by Hubble and various other instruments, there was sort of no possibility of developing a theory like that until you had a greater understanding of how the universe operated. So if you go back to these periods where a lot of these religious creation stories were created, they actually make a fair bit of sense based on what knowledge was available to them at the time, which is really all sciences as well. We are taking all the knowledge available, building hypotheses that explain everything we can see, and as we discover new things, our hypotheses have to be modified. And I think in that sense, you could call the early religious creation stories hypotheses for how the universe developed. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, and so what you're saying is there's actually some common ground between religion and science, but there are probably also equally important some big differences, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. A big difference, I think, with science is that it is built into the very concept that the story will change over time, that as new discoveries are made, these will be altered, while the most religious creation stories tend to have become, I don't know, calcified, I guess is the term I'd use, where they no longer change and no longer evolve and assume that the creation story as told must be the final truth. And so, of course, scientific method requires that new discoveries be incorporated and theories be altered as our understanding of the universe changes.
So this is one of many what you call false barriers, it seems. For example, different disciplines acting as silos and not talking with each other.
I can tell you've been reading some big history literature. As soon as you use the word silo, most of modern science has depended on the separation of subjects. So we have departments of chemistry, departments of biology, history, anthropology, etc., etc. And that's absolutely necessary because you have to have somebody who focuses on some tiny little aspect and becomes a world expert on that and then advances our knowledge. But this is also sometimes a problem because chemistry and biology are not really separate subjects. They're dealing with the same material. They're dealing with different aspects of the same material. So sometimes you get these artificial barriers that actually inhibit knowledge. So again, it's not right to say that it's a bad thing that knowledge is separated like that, but at the same time, we have to understand that that introduces artificial barriers. Well, I remember a fascinating piece I read where there was a chemist saying that the question of where life comes from to start with is not really a question of biology, it's really a question of chemistry, because all the theories say that you have inorganic material that somehow or other must assemble to become organic material that becomes life. So the question of how do you get life is a question of chemistry, not biology. But it's only because we separate knowledge between biology and chemistry that we even see that there is this barrier that has to be discussed, that one is part of the other. You have organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry. Biology depends on chemical processes and physics and the movement of electrons. Photosynthesis depends on the way sunlight affects the electrons in the plants. And these subjects can't really be separated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense to see things more as on a continuum.
Yes, exactly.
At one conference, I think you argued that consciousness or intention plays a much smaller role in human history than we think. How do you explain this?
Yes. The idea that human consciousness and human decisions is far less important than we realize. Well, I really came to this conclusion by studying the process of domestication of animals. Normally, we just assume this is something humans did to the plants and the animals. Humans came along and decided, I'm going to domesticate this animal, and then perhaps they capture a baby animal, they raise it in captivity, and thereby humans domesticate animals. But the physical evidence for the process of domestication of things like wheat and pigs and other animals actually doesn't support this idea. It takes thousands of years for these processes to develop. So, for example, with wheat, one of the processes that is associated with domestication is the encouragement by humans of non-shattering seeds. So normally grass spreads its seeds on the wind. The seeds will ripen, a strong wind will come along, the seeds will fly away and land wherever they will. Humans come along and they domesticate the plant, and suddenly you no longer get the wind shattering seed pods. Suddenly the seed pods are staying on the grass stems and humans are harvesting them. So it sounds like something that humans did. Generally, the literature and the descriptions of domestication, humans selected it, humans thereby created this. But in fact, what was going on was there were certain mutants within the grass species where the seed pods never shattered. So humans came along and started as hunter-gatherers and started gathering seeds in that field. And which seed did they gather? They didn't gather the seeds of the non-mutants because they had blown away and they were no longer there. Humans came along and started gathering the seeds that were still stuck on the grass stems, which, of course, were the genetic mutants that couldn't reproduce on their own. Now, with hundreds of years of humans following the same migratory patterns as hunter-gatherers, always returning at the same time of year to the same fields, gathering those same grass seeds, they thereby encouraged those seeds to reproduce because they took them off. Some of them dropped on the ground. They started growing. And then you have a biological divergence between the wild version of the grass, which spreads its seeds on the wind, and the domesticated version. So in that sense, yes, humans did it, but there was absolutely no conscious intention to do that. The only thing the humans did was something which was very animal-like. They knew to come to the same field every year to gather a food source that would be present and ripe at that exact time of year. And yet, because they do that pattern of behavior year in and year out for hundreds of years, gradually a version that we now call domesticated wheat emerges. But there was no decision to do that. It was just a natural evolutionary process, I guess you'd say.
So a bit of serendipity. And
yes.
Also, I think you described it at that conference as kind of a co-evolution, much like squirrels and certain trees.
Oh, absolutely. This is another one which I really like, up in Northern California, visiting the sequoia trees. So in the case of the sequoia tree, the sequoias depend on squirrels to reproduce. The squirrel wants to get the seeds the sequoia tree is growing, and without the squirrels going after the seeds, none of the tree's seeds will hit the ground, and therefore the sequoia won't be able to reproduce. We have a co-evolutionary pattern here. Now, we wouldn't say that the squirrel domesticated the sequoia any more than we'd say that the sequoia domesticated the squirrel. And the processes that developed between humans and animals and plants were much more akin to that. So, well, a really good example of this is the cat. People can relate to the idea that cats domesticated themselves. So humans settle down for agriculture. They start building granaries and having lots of waste in their villages. Naturally enough, mice and rats come to their villages. Therefore, animals that hunt the mice and rats also turn up in the villages. And now we have cats. Cats start hanging around human beings. They have a long process of many hundreds of years of just growing used to each other, becoming habituated to each other, if there's the languages. And gradually over time, the two species grow together, humans and cats. Nowadays, we talk about it as domestication, but anyone who's had a pet cat really knows that the cat is only sort of semi-domesticated at best. Now, it always seemed to be the case that cats were sort of the exception and all of the other animals were much the same. But what we're increasingly coming to realize is that almost all the other domestication events happened in a very similar way. So, for example, wild pigs started hanging around human farming communities because human farming communities were producing a lot of waste that they could access. That when you plow the field, you're digging up lots of roots that the pigs would like. So again, it seems to be the case that the pigs started hanging around human communities simply because humans were creating an environment that was beneficial for the pigs. And you see that gradually the shape of their teeth alters over the course of several thousand years, simply because the pigs no longer had to dig up roots from deep in the ground, so they didn't need those stronger teeth anymore. And only after several thousand years do you see an abrupt change, and we can tell what that is. That's when humans actually start managing the pigs and feeding them and giving them human waste. We can see from their bone samples and all sorts of other things that suddenly we have domestication. So the parallel I'd like to use there is actually those classic stories you see on so many love stories where there's a girl who likes a guy, but she doesn't want to make the first move. So she sets up lots of positions until eventually the dumb guy wakes up and finally gives her a kiss. And thereby everybody can say, she says, he says, the guy made the first move. But in fact, all of the pre-positioning for that to happen happened completely unconsciously as far as the guy was concerned. And that's really closer to what the domestication of these animals was like. 95% of the work was already done before humans actually seemed to sort of wake up to the fact, here we have these animals hanging around our communities, we could actually start actively managing them. It is a mutually beneficial relationship, just the same with fields of wheat. Again, we don't think of the wheat being an active participant in this alliance, but you think about what a human farming community is. Humans slave to make sure that more of the wheat grows than anything else. And then human beings build storehouses to store the seeds and protect them. They kill any competitors in the fields. We call that weeding. They introduce fresh food. We call that fertilizer for the plants. They introduce additional water supply so that grass can grow in areas where it normally would not be able to grow. And the human communities that succeed the most are the ones that actually help the grass grow the most and help them reproduce year in and year out.
One of the questions you're putting forward is who is really domesticating whom?
Absolutely. My studies of big history, and particularly the study of grass and the domestication of animals, has really fundamentally altered the way I see the rise of humanity. The traditional narrative is, you know, there was an old TV documentary called The Rise of Man. It's all about the rise of one species. But when you zoom out and look at it from a broader point of view, you actually see it's really the rise of an alliance. There's human beings, there's quite a number of different plants, but wheat and barley, corn and rice and plants like that are the most prominent. Then there are several animals, there are dogs, there are cows, there are sheep, and we all rise together. It's the rise of a multi-species alliance as opposed to the rise of a single species. There's so much stuff going on right now that involves harnessing the power of bacteria and viruses for our own purposes. I would actually see this as part of exactly the same process. It's a new wave of domestication. It's taken this level of science for us to get to that point where we can realize there's a whole other layer of life on Earth, and we're starting to form a whole bunch of these alliances with a bunch of bacteria species. A great example of this is the way they're already using viruses to combat food poisoning. So there's a particular virus that attacks the Listeria bacteria. So in supermarkets today, you'll sometimes see somebody going around spraying what looks like just water spray on the fish in the supermarket butcher deli section. What they're actually spraying on that fish is a virus. They're not going to promote it as a virus. They call them bacteriophages because, well, that sounds a lot nicer. And that virus is killing the bacteria that makes humans sick and enables those fish to stay on the supermarket shelf so much longer. There's other examples of bacteria that they're harnessing to potentially start making fuel for us, producing penicillin. There's another one where they're playing with the genetic makeup of E. coli to get it to attack one of the bacteria that contributes to pneumonia. So, in fact, right now, we're going through a whole wave of a new kind of domestication.
Since this is kind of tied into intention and consciousness, as we started to talk about this in those terms, one could argue, of course, that part of it is unconscious, like part of the development, this kind of coevolution that's happening probably within the genetic level, but that part of it is also conscious, even among the other species.
One thing I should stress is that when I talk about the lack of intentionality, that's usually in the early days of human domestication of plants and animals. Of course, by the time you get up to early modern Europe, you start to see really conscious breeding of animals. And today, with all our understanding of genetics, human beings now have fully jumped into the driver's seat, and they're consciously setting out to produce desired traits. That was some of Charles Darwin's most interesting observations. He was looking at racehorse breeding, pigeon breeding, and these kind of things, and that largely shaped his understanding of how these processes work, which is also probably why for so long we've always thought of it as being about conscious intention, because in the modern world it really is. We really are in the driver's seat now. But, of course, that also means those organisms are benefiting as well. One of the things that really changed my thinking about how the world works was one of the chapters in Jared Diamond's books, Guns, Germs, and Steel. In that book, he was talking about viruses and what works for a virus. Now, we always automatically tend to assume, at least I know I did, that the virus wants to kill us. The virus is our enemy. And it was only reading this chapter, and he was explaining that, of course, a virus doesn't actually want to kill its own host. The virus wants the host to live. So when you look at the evolutionary process of a virus over the long term, they tend to get less deadly. It tends to be the new viruses that wipe out large numbers of humans. And as time goes by, those viruses actually adapt to become less and less deadly. The perfect virus is a very mild flu that leaves you feeling well enough to go into work, so you can then cough on all your workmates and spread the virus to everybody else. So in that sense, we have other organisms that are using humans for their own benefit, but also their priorities are not necessarily the same priorities as ours.
You had written this history of the world from a different point of view. You said from the dominant species, and it was a non-human perspective. What is the dominant species?
Since I've been studying the history of grass, I thought, could I actually write a piece whereby I argued that grass was the dominant species on the planet and not humans? Why would I argue that grass was the dominant species? Well, if you go back and look at the history of the last 10 million years or so, you see that grass actually reshaped the planet in very much the same terms we tend to limit to human influence. So, for example, the spreading of the great grasslands, the prairies and the savannah and the Russian steppe, the Australian grasslands, is a relatively new phenomena. The grasslands spread and dominated about 20% of the land masses. And as a result, when we study the fossil record and the teat records, we find that they utterly shaped the makeup of the animal kingdom as well. So species that could live well in grassland environments thrived and grew. Species that didn't live well in grassland environments simply went extinct. In every single case where a major civilization has emerged, there's always been a grass in the picture. So in China, it was millet and rice. In the Middle East, it was wheat and barley. in Central America, it was corn. Even in South America, where they had the potato, corn was still playing a pretty important role. And so you can actually go as far to say, if there's no grass present, you don't get human civilization. So you get a picture emerging whereby you might say humans are the apex animal in the relationship, and grass is the apex plant in the relationship, and only when those two species come together do you get the whole phase that we now think of human history and civilization and all the rest. And human beings essentially become slaves of the grass. We spend vast amounts of resources, especially in the agricultural world. 95-98% of all people were involved in producing and preserving and processing those grass seeds, like wheat seeds and barley seeds and rice seeds. And if they succeeded, then the human species succeeded. If they failed, then human communities fell apart and you had war and anarchy and chaos and Malthusian collapse. And even today, it's our ability to produce enough wheat and barley and rice and corn around the world that enables us to sustain this modern world.
You wrote the piece arguing that humanity went from being free creatures to being indentured servants here.
We did. For example, anywhere in the world, when humans move to agriculture, they get weaker and more unhealthy. Their teeth rot, their bone strength and muscle mass reduces, their lifespans get reduced. In virtually every case, the move from being hunter-gatherers to agriculture made the life of an individual human much worse off. The way it helped us was our numbers were able to increase massively. Perhaps pre-agriculture, there might have been as few as 5 million human beings in the world, and pre-industrial revolution, that grew to about a billion people. But the average wealth or energy available per person never really grew. You have to wait till the Industrial Revolution before that really shows any significant improvement.
What does this tell us really about humanity?
If you ask me what the main thing about big history concerning our understanding of the world, it's brought me to increasingly think of human beings as part of the environment rather than separate from the environment, rather than the normal idea of you have human beings and you have nature as two separate things. It's really obvious to me now that human beings are simply one more dynamic in the natural cycle. Well, there's a sliding scale. Like, just one funny little fact, again, to make us realize that we're not quite as different as we like to believe, is the idea that human beings name their children. That's such a human trait. And yet, we suddenly find in the environment that there are lots of different creatures that have distinct names. We know dolphins give names to each other. We know that certain species of parrot give names to each other. And a recent study actually went and tried to work out, how does a parrot get its name? Is it somehow natural? Is it innate? Is it programmed in the DNA? And the conclusion they came to was, mummy and daddy name the baby. The baby will grow up understanding that's its name, and the rest of the birds will refer to that parrot by its name for the rest of its life. This is something that, until not that long ago, we would have thought, well, that's so purely human, and yet here we have a case where non-human creatures are doing the same thing. We are one more creature in the environment, perhaps a very interesting creature in the environment, one that's reshaped the planet in lots of ways, but we're not the only species that's done that. As I said, grass has done that as well. And we're also not unique or separated. We're part of the environment. We're of the environment. It's not humanity versus nature.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle, Jonathan Markley.
I had a good time. Thank you.
History professor Jonathan Markley teaches big history at California State University, Fullerton, and he's hosted a series of television programs on the subject. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.